originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Pena and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. That's right, it's Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch. Jude Feld, you know him. He's the Pontiff of the Pick Four, Pope Jude, whatever you want to go with. Happy to have you with us over the course of the next hour on Sirius 219, XM 206, and of course, all of you tuning in worldwide with our live streaming on your computer or your mobile device. It's there for you at horseracingradio.net. JT, each and every week, this show focuses on so many of the people that make this sport a success. And as you know, I'm talking about the trainers. And as a former trainer, you know the sacrifices and the dedication that has to come along with that profession better than anybody.
Well, it's a grind, and everybody that's been involved in racing knows how hard trainers work. I don't think they get enough credit a lot of times because everybody's out there every morning trying to do the best they can with their horses. And, you know, a lot of times the jockeys get a lot more adulation than trainers do, at least in the United States. In Europe, it's kind of the other way around. Yeah. The trainers are everything. But trainers work really, really hard, and they're all trying to do the same thing, get to the winner's circle and improve their horses. And so it's always good when we can put a spotlight on somebody who has a tremendous work ethic.
Yeah, very few trainers better at getting to the winner's circle than our guest here tonight, and that is trainer Tom Amos, who first joined us on this program, 4 or 5 years ago as we were just launching Trainer Talk. We spent a half hour with Tom, and he talked about his life and his background and growing up in New Orleans, and, well, he continues a huge, huge role. So we're happy to have Tom with us here this morning. Tom, welcome to the show, my friend.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Jude. I like that introduction. Jude hit it on the head. Not just me, but all trainers. They put in a great deal of time with their horses, and, you know, that has a lot to do with the success of those racehorses, knowing them, knowing their personality, and the only way you do that is by being around them as much as possible.
You notice I said we were happy to have Tom with us this morning.
Yeah.
Still that Belmont hangover here, I think, this week. Happy to have Tom with us here this afternoon on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Well, Tom, you know, I mentioned all those victories and those career wins. Well, 3,385 career wins to your credit. You're still going strong. And how about this? More than $91 million in purse earnings for your runners. That's impressive.
You know, it didn't start off like that. I remember back in 1988 at Sportsman's Park, where I had a small group of eight horses, and the first few I ran didn't hit the board, and I wondered, you know, am I ever going to see the winner's circle? So I think one of the things that motivates me is always that fear, the fear of not being able to keep up with the rest of the guys, and that's what gets me to the barn in the morning early and has me concentrating on trying to do a good job. A lot of that, of course, is putting your horses in the right spot. You can't do it without having the athletes, and I've had a lot of good athletes through my career.
Don't you find that sometimes when you do go into a losing streak or whatever, it's more about the quality of horses that you have rather than your skills?
Yeah, I think it's probably accurate, Jude, but, you know, for me, it's I'm always worried about what am I doing wrong. So, you know, and when we all go through it, I mean, everybody has hot and cold streaks. But it never fails to amaze me on occasion when the trainer tries to steal the spotlight from his athlete. Because really, in the end, I mean, there's only so much you can do. You can't make your horse better than he or she inherently is. But certainly through your efforts, you can make them worse. But in the end, it's about the athlete. And there are a lot of wins that you get in your career that, you know, looking back on them, it didn't matter who trained that horse because that horse was just that good. But when you get a win that's really sweet and you know you made a difference, which doesn't happen every time, by the way, those are really enjoyable.
Tom, you really question yourself from time to time?
In terms of my abilities?
Well, you said that you're always worried about what you're doing wrong. A guy like Tom Amos, people don't expect that he's going to ever question his approach because you've had so much success.
Yeah, I think that might be a personality flaw of mine. yes, I'm always looking at myself, and I'm always, like I said, fear of failure is a great motivation for me.
You hear that from other to Richard Mandela,
yep.
Graham Motion. I mean, now we hear it from you. There's a lot of guys at the top of the game that have tremendous success, and they still worry that maybe they screwed up somewhere along the line. I think that's good in a way, but I don't think you should let it consume you.
I'll try to keep that in mind, Jude.
Just call me anytime for advice, huh?
Right.
Tom, what is it when you look in the mirror and you look at your approach and your philosophy to training horses, what is it that you feel you do best?
Well, I think along the way, learning, so just going back in time a little bit, I knew very early on in my life that I wanted to be a horse trainer, and I had an approach to how I wanted to do it, and that approach certainly involved taking things from the different people I worked for. I still use the feed program that Jack Vanberg had back in the late 70s when I was just a hot walker for him. And, I'll match the look of my horse when he comes to the paddock in terms of health and color and brightness of coat with anybody. I think it's a great feed program, and it's not one of those where you buy a bag of feed and feed it. It involves a mix of oats, bran, sweet feed, barley, flaxseed, calf manioc, I could go on and on. There's a lot of ingredients to it. And I still use that same feed program. So I certainly took that from him. The bigger stables oftentimes are doing the same thing with all their horses. So I had the opportunity to work in a smaller stable at one point and learn to individualize the horses. And so I think if you were to say, when it comes to me, what do I do best? I think I attempt to at least individualize all the horses in the barn and try to do the right thing with them.
Well, and it's worked very, very well, and it's been very successful for Tom Amos. You mentioned the name Jack Vanberg, and that was somebody who, when you were in high school, you started hot walking for Jack Vanberg, and it sounds like he was a pretty good teacher too, Tom.
He's a great teacher. Jack pretends like he remembers me back then, but I mean, Jack was like these guys today that he had four or five outfits throughout the country. He was winning everywhere. As a matter of fact, at the fairgrounds, Frank Brothers was the assistant trainer way back when, and Jack would come in town. So I'm sure I was just another face in the crowd, but, and then not to say that Jack doesn't have a great memory, because he does, but he'll see me in the trainer's lounge at Churchill this year and or any other year for that matter. He'll reflect and say he remembered me way back when, which that's, and look, I'm honored that he says that, but it makes me scratch my head because I was just a hot walker back then.
Did you ever expect when you walked in his barn for the first time and you started walking hots for him that you'd be sitting here today, all these years later, having trained more than 3,300 winners?
Never in a million years. I mean, ironically, that barn at the fairgrounds where I had my first job on the backside is the same barn I operate out of today. So there are times where I walk in the morning, sit down at that desk, same desk, Jack sat down at, Frank Brothers sat down at, and now it's me in that barn 12 and at the fairgrounds. And who would have thought way back then it would come to that? And look, there were some pitfalls along the way. I mean, this job of getting to where you are the trainer is a grueling, grueling job. It's a learning curve. It's every day, and it's early, early in the mornings. And look, I'm fortunate enough that I had a who's now my wife, Colleen. But back then, someone who stood by me through the tough times. I mean, we'd go to dinner and I'd fall asleep at the table, or we'd go see a movie, I'd fall asleep in the movie. Those were a lot of long, long hours back then. The job has changed now. I still put in the hours, but it's not as physically demanding as the job of hot walking or grooming or assistant trainer. Those things are behind me.
Yeah, it is a lot tougher than people imagine to learn the craft. And then when it's your name in the program and the pressures involved, it's just like a pitcher who has to struggle with every at bat. It's a lot tougher than people think.
Yeah, so Gene's right. That's exactly right. So you wear a lot of hats. You've got to be a good communicator with your owners. You've got to be savvy on reading the form and picking out spots for your horses, as well as what has now become a big part of racing, except for some very elite stables, you know, the claiming game. You've got to be sharp at that because there's a lot of turnover when you're born. When you're trying to enter in a spot where you can be the most successful, oftentimes those horses are claimed by other trainers and they leave your barn. And, you know, if you're going to continue down the road of having a sizable stable, you know, there's going to be turnover and you're going to be bringing new horses, similar to, you know, a football team every season. The roster changes and you've got to be able to keep up with that. So you wear that hat. You wear the hat of a veterinarian in some sense. You've got to know what injuries or minor problems you need to stop on with your horse and what you can continue on with. And you know, you never want to run a horse that's not 100%. And so you have to have the knowledge of understanding what's going on with a little filling in an ankle or a little filling in a knee and how significant or not significant that is. Nutritionalist, you know, you've got to be able to look at your horses, understand their health by looking at them, and then applying the right things when those things don't match up well with what, you know, is in your head should be the correct way the horse is training, looking, or running.
Talking with trainer Tom Amos here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Tom, people won't realize you have a close relationship with another native of New Orleans, and that's your good friend Al Stahl Jr. Talk a little bit about that relationship.
Well, Al's family got me involved in racing. Al and I are childhood friends. Al's father was a commissioner of racing in Louisiana and a horse owner. So when we became friends, oftentimes I would go to the track with them in the afternoon. And my relationship with horse racing started off as a handicapper. Look, when I was age 12 or 13, I was fluent in reading the form. I enjoyed handicapping from the aspect of I really don't think there's a better feeling than dissecting a race before it happens, all the information you have, and then watching it unfold just the way you thought it would. And so I enjoyed that back then. I'm not much of a better anymore, but I'm fortunate enough that I still get to use that with TVG and with the NYRA during Saratoga meet. So that's how I started out. And maybe a year into it, one night I spent the night at Al's house, and on a Saturday morning his dad went out to watch his horses training. And that's the first time that I got to visit the backside, probably age 14 at the time, and I saw all the things that went into what you do to get a horse ready to run in a race over, you know, a period of a morning. And before then, I just thought, you know, you put them in the gate, the fastest one wins. But when I saw that on the backside, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. And so it's like, you know, going to see your favorite play 8 to 10 times, and then getting to go backstage and seeing all the work that goes into making what happens on stage look so good. But for me, that was an eye opener, quite frankly, it changed my life.
Do you find that because you were such a good handicapper at an early age, that helps you a lot in the claiming game?
I do. That's a very good question, and I don't think there's any doubt in my mind that helps. You know, it's funny. So going up in New Orleans, I used to take the streetcar to school. And back then, when print media was big, New Orleans had a morning and an evening paper. So I'd come home on the streetcar from school at about 3 in the afternoon, and at the newspaper stand close to my house, I would always buy that day's form, even though half the race had already run. I'd stick it in my books, and I'd get to my house, and my mom would say, okay, look, you know, you got a couple hours to do your homework before you can go out and do anything. And I'd go in my room, and I'd handicap for 2 hours. And then because racing was a big deal back then as well, when the news came on that night, they would review, you know, the how the card went, and I could compare how I had done against the actual results. So I didn't get much homework for it, and my grades reflected that. But I did learn to read the form very, very well.
Well, some great comments from Tom Amos, our guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Great comments about his good friend Al Stahl Jr. as well. Tom, people won't realize that you were college roommates at LSU, you and Al. What kind of a roommate was Al Stahl Jr.?
Well, we were a lot alike. You know, on Wednesdays, if any of us felt like going to class, we'd tend to make a trip down to New Orleans and be at the fairgrounds together. So we kind of supported each other as far as that goes. I graduated with a degree in marketing. Al graduated with a degree in geology, and a lot of people don't know this, but started off as a geologist and was working in New Orleans. At the time that he was doing that, and he got out of school, I think a semester later than I did, I was up in New York working for John Caracella as his assistant trainer. And I can recall talking to Al during that time, because we are still very good friends, by the way. I can recall talking to Al at that time, and I could hear how much he missed the track. And there was a real drought in the oil business in New Orleans, and a lot of people lost their jobs. And probably the greatest thing that happened to Al is it gave him an opportunity to step away from that and to go on to do what his real passion was, and that's train horses.
Yeah, that's been highly successful for Al, highly successful for Tom Amos as well. Tom, let's spend some time talking about some of the career highlights that, you know, you've experienced over the years. And let's start with your very first career win, which was back on March 24th of 1987. You know I'm talking about...
I can tell you the name.
Go ahead.
Prize Green.
You never forget your first.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. There's a good story behind her. So, that was at Sportsman's Park, and I was preparing her to run, and I liked her as a racehorse. And I worked her one morning, and I had brought my own jockey from New Orleans, a jockey named Abner Sorrows Jr. I don't know if that's a name you guys recognize from way back when. But so Abner, who was a country boy, he worked with me one morning. And she didn't finish up well at the end of the work, and it was the last work before we were getting ready to run. I was really discouraged. And I asked him about it after the work, and he was like, well, he was very general in what he said. So we went in the race, and she won easy. And my first win, so Abner and I went to dinner that night along with our wives, and we were sitting down. He said, Tom, I got to confess something to you. And I said, what's that? He goes, well, I don't know Sportsman's Park very well, and I thought the 16th pole was the wild. I'd been watching from the other side of the track. So I stopped him at the 16th pole, and that's why she didn't look like she finished well to you, because I'd already pulled her up, but I was too embarrassed to tell you that before the race.
Great story. Of course, that was back in 1987, and Tom's been saddling winners ever since. How about that first stakes win, Tom? Do you remember that day?
Okay, hold on. Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was the biggest career break I ever had. Fire the Shot in the Gator Handicap.
Yep.
Yeah, no, Fire the Shot was another interesting story. So I was training at Sportsman's in 87. My next stop was probably Thistle Downs, and the girl that galloped for me was the sister-in-law of John Caracella. And John was in the blood horse, you know, every time they published the magazine. He had just horse after horse after horse. And she told me that he was looking for an assistant. And would I be interested? And I was like, absolutely. I would love to go to New York. I would love to learn from John. And anyhow, I got that job. And so I left in 87. I stopped training and became an assistant up at Belmont Park for John. And I gave the horses that I had to the sister-in-law, and she went on to train those horses for a while, growing Tori Belpedio. But I'll never forget when I went to New York and thought, this is going to be, you know, all-encompassing, the you know, the real year I need to have before I return my own. We won the California Derby, the Simply Majestic, and the day that I signed with him, the form said California Simply Majestic wins California Derby on the Kentucky Derby. And the headline of the form the next day read, Simply Majestic mistakenly not nominated to the Kentucky Derby. And that tended to be the way it was in that stable. There was a lot of chaos from time to time. If you know John at all, you know he's brilliant. But sometimes the details are left behind.
Well, he is kind of a wild man, John Parcell. I met him a couple times when he came to California, and he's a character. But you're right. He, for a while there, he was just winning everything. He had the best stable around, and that must have been quite a thrill to go to work for him.
It was great. That was a great New York experience that year with John. So. I look back on it with great memories. I was recently married at the time. We were just newlyweds. We lived in somebody's basement in New York and paid about $800 in rent, which I still scratch my head about, but that's the way it is in New York. those are the kind of things you look back on. You wouldn't want to do them again, but you like to know you have them in your back pocket that you did them.
Well, the first graded stakes win of your career would come 2 years later. That was in 1990, and I'm sure you remember that day at the fairgrounds.
Oh, man.
Oh, come on. You've been so good.
Graded stakes win. Hold on. It wasn't the New Orleans Handicap, was it?
It was the New Orleans Handicap.
Okay, then it had to be festive.
It was festive. Yeah.
It was festive, yeah. I do remember that day very, very well. So my family is in New Orleans, and I have five brothers. And on that particular day, everybody was out at the track for that race. And we won it for John Franks on that day. And when we were going to the winner's circle, the manager of the racetrack said, Tom, you can only bring four people in the winner's circle because we're doing this in the infield. And I turned to him and I said, you know what? I don't know what the limit is on people that you can bring in the infield, but I'm bringing everybody. And I just walked right through with everybody, much more like 20 people. But in the end, they didn't mind. And I don't keep a lot of wind pictures, like maybe in albums, of course. But I still have that wind picture hanging in my basement. That was a lot of fun that day.
What are some of the other moments when Tom Amos gets a few minutes to be alone and think back on all the horses, all the people you've been around? What are some of the moments that stand out to you in your career, Tom?
I think the thing that I think about the most, Mike, is the lucky breaks I got. You know, you mentioned Fire the Shot, my first stakes winner. So at that time, I was just starting out in Louisiana, and a couple of things had occurred. Number one, Frank Brothers, who was the perennial leading trainer down there, had taken a private job and was moving out of the state. So that was one thing. And then the second leading trainer had health issues and stepped away from racing. So there's a real void as to, you know, who was going to step up and who was going to kind of be the one to start winning races. And that timing worked out well for me. As far as Fire the Shot goes, he was one of five horses I had in my barn. I was so desperate for horses that I actually had a pair of horses from an owner in Texas named John and Brad Ballou. Those were the name of the horses. And when the papers came on them, they were identical. And I could not figure it out. And I called the owner, and he said, oh, well, I got lucky. These horses are twins. So in the world of racing, twins is no good because they're usually undersized. They were very undersized. But in this guy's mind, because he had twins, he had two chances at the race like instead of one. So we had a pair of twins in the barn. I had Fire the Shot, and then I had a good horse named He's a Bear. And He's a Bear was owned by a guy that was very volatile, fired trainers all the time. But he gave me a chance, and I'll never forget that he gave me that chance. So the day that Fire the Shot won that stake race, he actually was entered the same race as He's a Bear. He's a Bear ran that same stakes race. He's a Bear was favored in that race. Fire the Shot was not. So the race ran. This was long before simulcast, long before cell phones. And they used to lock up the phones at the racetrack so that nobody could call during the race. And they'd unlock them when the race were over. Well, this stakes race was late in the day. We won it. I was celebrating up front. I got back to the barn probably a half an hour after the races had ended. And I had hired a kid that was just wanting a summer job. And I asked him about He's a Bear's owner, a gentleman named Mike Steep. I said, hey, did Mike call? And the hot walker said, yeah, he did. And I said, what did he say? Because, of course, his horse lost. He said he wanted to know how we'd done in the stakes race, and I told him we had won. And I said, no, his horse didn't win. The other horse in the race won. He goes, oh, he thinks his horse won. He's going to call you in about 10 minutes. Oh, my God. So I sat down at my desk, and I just stared at the phone. And when it rang, it was like a time bomb going off. But I picked it up, and Mike was all happy. He said, hey, we win, huh, Tom? And I said, no, Mike, we ran fifth. Well, Mike wasn't a dummy, and he said, well, where did that other horse of yours run? And I said, he won it. And Mike said, huh. And I learned the next day that in Louisiana, huh means you're fired. The next day, I only had three horses instead of five. I had two twins, and I had fire the shot. But that win had gotten the attention of John Franks, who was the biggest owner in Louisiana and maybe in the whole nation at the time. And Mr. Franks had seen the race. He called me the same day, and he offered me a few horses, just three or four. Every one of those horses won when I ran them. And I never looked back from there. So when I reflect, I oftentimes think of the lucky breaks I got along the way that got me to where I am.
Well, and he's had several breaks. He's had a lot of success. He is trainer Tom Amos, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Tom, been a delight to talk with you here today. Can't thank you enough for taking a little time. Want to wish you all the best moving forward, my friend, and can't wait to see you soon.
Thanks for everything, you guys. Mike, Jude, have a great day, and good luck at the races.
Tom, you too. Tom Amos here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. JT, been a lot of fun.
Yeah, Tom's a great guy, and some fantastic stories.
Yeah, for our producer, that is my beautiful wife, Michelle, pushing all the right buttons here today. For Jude, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.
Nominate your yearlings now to the Fasic Tipton Summer Selected Yearling Sales. These sales are the top three yearling sales in North America by rate of return. The July sale in Lexington, Kentucky, July 10th and 11th. The Saratoga sale in Saratoga Springs, New York, August 7th and 8th. And the New York bread sale in Saratoga Springs, New York, August 12th and 13th. Selected sales, superior results. Nominate today at FasicTipton.com.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at BloomRacing.com.
Kentucky Downs kicks off a unique 5-day all-grass race meet in September. Live racing September 3rd, 8th, 10th, 11th, and 15th. And the stakes are high with $7.8 million in purses over the 5 days, an average of $1.56 million each day. Kentucky Breds will run for maiden special weight purses of $130,000 and allowance purses of $145,000. Maidens not bred in Kentucky will compete for $58,000 with top allowance for non-Kentucky Breds at $67,000. Learn more at KentuckyDowns.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best. And to stand the best. Windstar Farm. Dedicated to the dream.
Now is the perfect time to own a Kentucky bred and race in Kentucky. Kentucky breds win 70% of the greatest stakes in North America, and it's obvious that Kentucky breds start with a clear advantage. But there's more. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start. Learn more at KentuckyBred.org.